From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In the Mideast and around the world tonight, Palestinians mourn the death of Yasser Arafat, symbol of their unrealized national aspirations. Arafat was a leader and a divider. Washington called him an obstacle to peace. Israel called him a master terrorist. But now he is gone, and there may be an opening for peace. This evening, British Prime Minister Tony Blair is meeting with President Bush in Washington, urging him to take the lead in pushing Mideast peace. The time could be ripe. Bush is shaking up his cabinet and setting new priorities for his second term. In Israel, the old adversary, Arafat, is not there to be blamed. Tonight on Point, the chance of a breakthrough after Arafat. Our coverage begins in Ramallah, where Arafat is to be buried after his funeral in Cairo tomorrow. Saeed Ghazali reports for the Boston Globe from Ramallah. I asked him to describe how Palestinians are responding to news of Yasser Arafat's death.
Well, most Palestinians are very sad. They miss him as a leader and a symbol for Palestinian people. But at the same time, they look at the future. And they are not sure what will happen in the future, whether there will be democracy, elections, reform, or just fears and uncertainties and problems. What most Palestinians want is to improve their economic conditions, to improve their daily life. And they don't have, for the last 4 years, any chance to achieve that. They still live in poverty. They live in incarcerated cities. They don't have free movement. They suffer a lot, and there is no hope. I don't know whether all this legacy of violence, legacy of corruption, occupation, could be resolved in a short period. I doubt that.
Saeed, when Palestinians, as Palestinians, consider Yasser Arafat's death and the reality that you describe, do they blame that violence, the occupation, the troubles in their daily life? I'm sure many do on Israel, but do they also blame it in part on Yasser Arafat?
That's right. You know, Yasser Arafat has got all the powers, the authorities. He controlled everything in the lives of Palestinians, politics, PLO, it is under his hand, Palestinian Legislative Council, PNC, Palestinian National Council, Fatah Central Council. He puts everything in his hand. And negotiation, even the preparations for elections, he wants to design it in a way that he will get the results as he likes. You know, they open registration for elections, but he doesn't want opponents to register, and that's why he had some problems. There is no fairness in the election, even they prepare for it. What I'm saying is that there is a lot of problems. Arafat is responsible for it, and also Israel is responsible for it, and most importantly, the Americans. The Americans should play a role in this area, and this is very useful to them if they approach this area and help us, help Palestinian people, to carry out genuine and fair elections. We don't have free media, for instance. If you read our newspapers, you read only one opinion, one idea. You don't see a lot.
Saeed Ghazali, I want to ask you specifically about Arafat's death. The last week has been confusing and emotional, with him in Paris, confusing reports on his health, his wife Suha blaming other Palestinian leaders, accusing them of attempting to bury him alive. How have Palestinians in the West Bank followed all of this news?
They are very confused. They have a lot of suspicions about what has happened, really, and we don't have information about it.
Now Yasser Arafat's funeral is to be held at the airport in Cairo, and then his burial is said to be planned for his shattered headquarters there in Ramallah. What kind of ceremony, what kind of public reception do you expect at his funeral and burial?
I expect a large number, maybe thousands. A lot of people will come. At this moment, it is very emotional moment for many Palestinians, when somebody like him as a leader for 40 years die, even his opponents want to give him respect. And they don't talk about the past, the problems.
There have already been attacks on an Israeli settlement in the aftermath of his death and also killings of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers. Do you expect this will be a violent few days surrounding Arafat's funeral?
Yeah, I do expect incidents here and incidents there, but I don't think that it will be a large scale of violence. Maybe the Palestinians still believe that Israel is bears some sort of responsibility because he was incarcerated for more than 3 years in Muqata'a, and maybe this is one of the reasons. Of course, the street people, you know, maybe they act emotionally because they don't have information.
And finally, Saeed, what about the leadership that's been installed with Yasser Arafat's death, a kind of collective leadership with moderates and hardliners? Is this seen as something that can last? Is there a consensus that you can detect among Palestinians about who they expect to emerge as the primary leader of the Palestinians now?
One thing, it is very important to have elections. It is up to the Palestinian people, whether they choose X or Z, or Hamas program or Fatah program, they vote for Abu Mazen. It is a right for the Palestinian people to do that. About the collective leadership, I think here there are two programs, and there is no reconciliation between the two programs. It is the program of Abu Mazen or the PA. They want to solve the problems through negotiation. And the radical problem is Hamas or Islamic Jihad, and they want to continue the resistance. I cannot imagine how you can bring these two conflicting programs together under a banner of collective leadership. Hamas and the Islamists should make a compromise to the PA because it's impossible for the PA to adopt the option of resistance.
But big decisions in the days ahead for the Palestinians. Saeed Ghazali, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks. Bye.
Saeed Ghazali reports from the West Bank for the Boston Globe. He spoke with me from Ramallah. We turn next to Washington, where Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush are scheduled for dinner this evening and meetings and a lunch tomorrow in a whirlwind visit by the British leader. Before leaving London today, Blair said he would urge President Bush to reinvigorate efforts for peace in the Middle East. Justin Webb is Washington correspondent for the BBC and joins me now. Justin, how high an agenda item on Tony Blair's agenda in Washington is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Oh, it's right at the top. No question about that. And it's at the top for international reasons, but it's also at the top, frankly, for domestic political considerations in Britain. Tony Blair needs to persuade members of his own Labour Party that he is getting something out of his relationship with George Bush. There was, frankly, widespread dismay in Britain when Mr. Bush was re-elected. I don't think that's putting it too strongly, and particular dismay inside Mr. Blair's own party. Mr. Blair, of course, doesn't share that dismay. He says he gets something out of this relationship. Well, this is the test. Is he going to get something out of it? Because what he wants more than anything on the international stage is for an America which is re-engaged in the peace process and does things on the ground that Mr. Bush has not considered doing so far. So all eyes in Britain are on Mr. Blair, and the question he is being asked now is, can you deliver? Can you look the president in the eye and get him to agree to things that he has not until now agreed to?
Justin Webb, help us understand this picture. If we could build it from the ground up, what's the popular perception in the UK of the standoff in the Middle East, and you're here in Washington, you see how Americans think about it. How do the English think about it, the British think about it differently,
you know,
and how?
It's completely different, and it's different almost at a kind of visceral, cultural level, that in America, Israel is widely regarded as a plucky, tiny country, a democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East, all around surrounded by mortal enemies, people who would destroy the state if they had the chance, and particularly with the added business of 9/11 and America's world view since then. And the view here is so very obviously one in which Israel is seen widely as the victim in all of this. The view in Europe and largely in Britain is almost the complete opposite, actually, that the Palestinians have been victimized by Arab nations, which haven't helped them in the past, victimized by the Israelis, which have occupied their territories. And the view in Britain, certainly the majority view in Mr. Blair's Labour Party, is that the real victims here are the Palestinians. So there is this kind of, at a really basic level, just a fundamentally different way of looking at the Israel-Palestine situation. Now, that needn't, of course, and doesn't, frankly, affect either President Bush or Tony Blair, because they're looking at practical steps and what they can and can't feel able to do now. But that is where their nations are coming from. And I think there's no question at all that that difference of vision certainly informs the way in which politicians in both countries approach these problems, and I guess the way in which the president and the prime minister do as well.
So when Tony Blair went before the Labour Party conference in September, he had to make this kind of statement. He said, "The party knows the depth of my commitment to the Middle East peace process and shares my frustration at the lack of progress." He said, "After November, that is the presidential election in the U.S., I guess, I will make its revival a personal priority." Is the feeling, as he comes to Washington tonight, that he's got the chips in his pocket to make George Bush respond?
Well, you know, there's a lot of skepticism in Britain about whether he does have the chips in his pocket. I think, frankly, if he did make President Bush respond, and we've got to decide what responding actually would be. I mean, nobody on the British side is suggesting that the president is going to call an immediate peace conference of some sort and invite whoever takes over the Palestinian leadership with Ariel Sharon to come to Camp David. I mean, there's no suggestion that that is in the offing. What the British are looking for is much smaller steps, but steps in which two things happen. Number one, there is that practical help, which your previous contributor was talking about, practical help in elections, practical help in security. But number two, that the president himself personally gets involved, that he is making phone calls, not necessarily going to the Middle East himself, but that he is pushing the thing along in a way, I suppose, that President Clinton did. So that's what people are looking for in Britain. Are they expecting it to happen? I have to say I've been telling them, for what it's worth, that it's not very likely to happen. And for very obvious reasons, there are all sorts of reasons why President Bush might not go down that road. So that there is an expectation at the British government level that anything that did happen would be small, and there is a belief at the British public level, I think, and in those people in Britain who are interested in Israeli-Palestinian affairs, an expectation, frankly, that not much is going to come of this meeting.
You're in Washington. President Bush has just won re-election. Why do you say he's unlikely to go down that road? How are you reading the tea leaves in Washington right now?
I suppose because, for one thing, at an overarching level, the political risks are simply too high. The president does not share the world view of Tony Blair, which is that Israel-Palestine is the nub of all Middle Eastern issues, and that if you can solve Israel-Palestine or deal with Israel-Palestine, then everything else falls into place, including Iraq, including even the situation in Iran with its nuclear weapons, that somehow that avoidance of the poison caused by Israel-Palestine then allows you to do other things. Now, I don't seriously think that Mr. Bush believes that. I don't think his senior advisers believe that. I think, with the possible exception of Colin Powell, I think they believe that these are separate issues and that you have to sort out Iraq and that you have to be strong in the face of terrorism. And that actually is the key to success in the Middle East. And I think with that fundamental difference, I just can't see Mr. Bush changing course or feeling the need to change course or indeed feeling that it would be wise to change course, whatever Tony Blair says to him.
And yet Tony Blair was the one who stood by him like no other leader on the planet through his first term, who was there at every possible term, there for those State of the Union meetings, there every single time. If George Bush doesn't respond on this issue, is Tony Blair likely to take it as a personal affront, as a kind of betrayal of a relationship, of an alliance, a commitment?
You know, Tony Blair is not like George Bush in the sense of seeing everything in black and white terms and seeing individuals in black and white terms. Remember, he got on just as well, frankly, with Bill Clinton as he did with George Bush. He is a very malleable politician. He's a politician who understands that politics is the art of the possible, and that there might be all sorts of reasons why President Bush doesn't find it possible to do all sorts of things at the moment. I don't think Tony Blair will take offense, and frankly, you know, he can't afford to take offense. He's got to, to put it bluntly, to put on a pretense to the British people that he's getting something out of this relationship. He can't flounce off at this late stage with British...
And say, "I've been abused." Justin Webb, we've got to go, but thanks very much for being with us tonight. Justin Webb with the BBC in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about new opportunities for Mideast peace with the death of Yasser Arafat. You can join our conversation tonight. Is this the time to seize the day, to do what it takes to hammer out peace between Israelis and Palestinians at long last? Will we ever get a cleaner slate than right now for Mideast peace? And there's this, who really wants a two-state settlement here? Israel, the Palestinians, the U.S.? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Bronxville, New York, is Fawaz Jerjes, professor of Middle East and International Affairs and International Relations at Sarah Lawrence College, author of The Jihadists, Unholy Warriors. Fawaz Jerjes, good to have you with us again. Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
And with me in the studio tonight, Robert Mnuchin, professor and chair of the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School. He's been an active behind-the-scenes voice in Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations for many years. Robert Mnuchin, thanks for being here this evening.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Fawaz Jerjes, first to you, how do you see this moment? Yasser Arafat is gone. This is a moment that some have feared, but Israelis, many, and leaders in Washington, many, have at some level longed for a long time. Now it's a fact. Is there a window of opportunity here?
Well, Tom, as you know, the conventional wisdom in the United States and Israel for the last 3 years is that Yasser Arafat is the major impediment to peacemaking between Palestinians and Israelis.
We've heard it again and again.
Absolutely. And this has been, they have trafficked in this particular, and I think to his credit, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has succeeded in not only convincing the Bush administration that Yasser Arafat was the major impediment to peacemaking, but also that his war with the Palestinian is an extension of the American war on terrorism. Well, the reason why I believe, Tom, that there is a small window of opportunity is that I think Ariel Sharon is running out of justifications and excuses. Now Arafat is out of the scene. There is a new hope that the Palestinians would establish a new dynamic leadership, a dynamic leadership that has a popular mandate. The Palestinians, I think, are mature enough to realize that the only way for them to have a popular mandate is to have national elections. We have a president with a second term in power. Now, the critical question on the table is the following. Will President W. Bush become much more actively in the peace process and exert more pressure on his friend Ariel Sharon, who, according to one of our former national security advisors, wraps the president around his finger, quote, unquote? And will Israeli Prime Minister show a genuine interest in moving forward and engaging the Palestinian politically? And the challenge, Tom, also is on the new Palestinian leadership to begin the process, the difficult, painful, complex process of putting their house in order, of charting a new course, a blueprint that says violence, military struggle is out of the door, political and civic dissent is the only way forward.
Robert Mnuchin, how do you see it? Fawaz Jerjes looks, he says, maybe Arafat wasn't as big an impediment to peace as was asserted, but in any case, he's gone. He puts most of the onus at this point on Israel and the United States, and yet we've still got this collective kind of unresolved leadership issues within the Palestinian community. Do you see a window of opportunity here, and what would first steps in acting on it look like?
I think there is an opportunity, but I think things are really more complicated. There's something very paradoxical about the situation with respect to the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. If there is a negotiated deal, we all know what the essential elements of it would be.
Been on the table for a long time.
It's not so far from what President Clinton proposed. It's not so far from the things that were raised in the Geneva Initiative or the Nasseba Ayalon Initiative. And it seems to me reasonably clear that moderates on both sides probably could make a deal. The real difficulty, and this hasn't changed simply by reason of President Arafat's death, is that behind the table, among Israeli Jews on the one hand, there is a profound conflict over the settlements project and what should come of it. And behind the table, on the Palestinian side, there are lots of different factions. And as was described by one of your earlier guests, their conflicting programs. Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who have some authority, really don't accept even the legitimacy of a two-state solution, as is also true, by the way, by some settlers on the Israeli side. And I think that for progress to be made, it's going to depend a lot on what happens behind the table on each side with respect to these internal conflicts.
If both sides then carry this on their shoulder, large, strong factions that don't want the settlement that's been proposed, does that leave it, as Fawa suggests, in America's corner to push? A, does the United States have the capacity to push it through to help the moderates who want it to happen make it happen in spite of that opposition? And B, do you see the willingness, the readiness in the Bush administration term two?
Well, I think that two things are true. On the one hand, without substantial American involvement, it's going to be next to impossible for there to be much progress. On the other hand, I do not believe it correct that American involvement and American pressure can resolve in any easy way these internal conflicts. American involvement and American pressure isn't going to resolve issues having to do with Palestinian leadership, who's going to be the leader or the leaders, what control they'll have over more extreme elements on the one hand. And on the other hand, I think there are real limits in terms of the internal politics within Israel that an American president can make a difference. What's clear that President Bush has done is they have been very supportive of Prime Minister Sharon's initiative, which I view as
this is pulling out of Gaza, but asserting Israel's position in the West Bank.
Pulling completely out of Gaza with respect to settlers, and a limited pullout in some portions of the West Bank, coupled with the so-called wall or fence.
Right, and you view it as an extreme.
I view the pullout of Gaza as absolutely critical and indispensable. And I think, in fact, President Bush has bent over backwards to try to help Prime Minister Sharon domestically achieve that end. It's not clear whether Sharon will achieve it. And it's a little bit like Nixon going to China, as you well understand. Sharon, the champion of the settlements movement, is perhaps among the few, if only, Israeli politicians that may be able to pull off
with the standing to say, we've got to do this.
We've got to do it.
Fawaz, you're just looking into that Palestinian leadership with us for a moment. On the one hand, the big kind of conflict that we heard described from Ramallah by Saeed Ghazali, that is it going to be the moderates or is it going to be Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the driver's seat? And how does leadership get resolved here? You've now got Mahmoud Abbas as chairman of the PLO, of course, Ahmed Korea as prime minister, but some harder liners around as well. Do we need to wait for one single leader to emerge? And do you see the likelihood of the emergence of either a clear moderate impulse or a clear hardline mandate?
Well, Tom, the Palestinians will go to the polls in 60 days. That is at least what they have decided on in 60 days.
That's what's required, right?
Yes, and that's what obviously it seems to me the dominant current among the new Palestinian leadership, the collective leadership, is that elections are crucial for them to have a popular mandate. But just a few points about elections. You have almost 500 military Israeli checkpoints throughout the West Bank and Gaza. 500 military checkpoints.
Are those an impediment to voting? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. How can you move forward? I mean, that's really Ariel Sharon, the question. I mean, we talk about the various internal tensions and contradictions among Palestinians and Israelis. Why shouldn't we talk about Ariel Sharon's vision for peace? What is Ariel Sharon's vision for peace, Tom? And this is, I mean, I think the implicit, the unspoken, at least, puzzle. His vision for a peace process is a Palestinian state on less than 60% of the West Bank and Gaza, with no Palestinian state in East Jerusalem. And we talk about the American involvement. Not only the United States, not only this administration, has fully supported Israel, in particular Ariel Sharon, but in fact has taken a radical, dramatic position on the question of settlements, on the question of territories, even on the question of East Jerusalem. And this is why it's essential here. I mean, absolutely, they are rejectionists. And the rejectionists are Hamas, Jihad, Ariel Sharon, and his, of course, settler friends. And this is why I think American leadership is essential here. American leadership, we're not talking here about a normative, theoretical, academic question.
Yeah.
The United States here provides Israel with more than $3 billion, not just in terms of aid, but also political prestige and political support.
And so the question is tonight whether this departure of Yasser Arafat, and we're mindful that he still hasn't even had his funeral yet. He's certainly not even buried yet. Many Palestinians are mourning the loss of a leader tonight. Nevertheless, we can see over the rim of this now, and the question is whether this changes the chemistry in some fundamental way or changes it enough that we might get a breakthrough here. Let's bring our callers into this conversation. John is calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing today?
We're just fine, John. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I think what sort of taints the discussion here is the fact that there's been no movement, and there's a lot of frustration, really, in the whole process. But one thing I think we're forgetting here is there's been no peace in the Mideast as long as Arafat has been involved.
But Arafat's gone, so?
So now we have a new opportunity. And so, I think that, Israel, obviously of late, has not wanted to come to the table with Arafat. And so really I think the burden is on Palestine at this point.
You're saying let them step up, but of course Arafat's gone, so everybody has a chance to step up now. And yes, the bitterness there has been deep. Justice Minister Yosef Lapid in Israel today spoke of a, quote, deep hatred for a man who made terrorism a method in the world. That sentiment remains, but yes, Arafat is now gone. I want to welcome into our conversation from Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, Ian Lustig. He's professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands. Ian Lustig, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
What do you make of the future absent Yasser Arafat? Leaders in Washington and Israel have one way or another said that's what they long for. Now it's here. Has it changed the chessboard in a fundamental way?
Well, I agree with much of what's been said already. The chessboard has been changed, but some of the major pieces are still exactly where they were. We don't know whether they're going to move or not. And the big piece that everyone has got their eye on is President Bush. Of course, having been reelected now, he is in a position to use some of the political capital he says he's got. He's being asked, importuned by Prime Minister Blair. But just as you have heard from your other guests, a certain lack of confidence that that's going to happen, I also would think that one of two things has got to happen for that to be realistic. Given that his advisors are overwhelmingly opposed to that kind of initiative, I'm talking about people like Elliot Abrams, who's the National Security Advisor on the Middle East, mm-hmm. and a well-known super hawk from an Israeli point of view on these issues, people like Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith, who exercise still very important clout. One of two things has to happen. Either the situation in Iraq has to get even worse, so bad that even the president and his advisors realize that they need the kind of international and European assistance that they can only get by bringing Palestinians and Israelis to the table.
Right.
Or if Prime Minister Sharon takes the initiative and then President Bush will follow. We know that it was President Bush who called Ariel Sharon a man of peace. He has strived for mostly for domestic political reasons, but also because his advisors ideologically and theoretically just do not believe in the idea of a two-state solution. His notion has been to not allow daylight to emerge between the Israeli government position and the American position.
So Sharon might be the one who flips the trigger here,
well,
if indeed it happens. What would make that happen? Yeah,
that's a little new. I think that Sharon himself may have some incentive to do something different than he's done in the past. In the past, he has used Arafat as a demon, as an excuse not to negotiate,
mm-hmm.
because he didn't want to get to the agreement that Professor Mnuchin mentioned, the Geneva Agreement, the Clinton parameters, the two-state
mm-hmm.
solution. That that any serious negotiation will get to within 3 months. Sharon did not want to do that. He used the existence of Arafat and the belief by the Israeli people that he was a super terrorist and responsible for the fact that there was supposedly no partner. He used that to avoid negotiations. He could continue to do that sort of thing by generating another demon or by conducting high-profile attacks in the West Bank against terrorists.
But what might prompt him to go another way, Ian Lustig?
I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. He adopted the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, which would not require him to negotiate with the Palestinians. And his own advisor, Dov Weisglass, has said the purpose of that was to put the Palestinian problem in formaldehyde for 30 years. Mm. You would be able to impose what I call a one-and-a-half-state solution, something with a Gaza statelet and a couple cantons in the West Bank that would not have to be the result of negotiations.
And you're saying post-Arafat he would move to confirm that, or that he would give that up and move another way?
That's right. Now, why would he back away from that intention? Because many people in Israel, on the left and on the right, are very scared of the results of the withdrawal from Gaza if it is unilateral. That all hell may break loose in Gaza with no one to take over, with no arrangements with Israel to transfer the property, for to arrange for economic opportunities, for the legitimacy that could adhere to a leadership that negotiated the withdrawal, it could result in much more violence directed against Israel, a deteriorating security situation, or at least the accusation that is from Israelis that Israel left Gaza and got nothing in return. So some people on the right, including the Shas, or a religious party,
yes,
have said what we oppose about the withdrawal is not the withdrawal, but the fact that it's unilateral. So if Sharon sees the absence of Arafat, when everyone's saying, okay, Sharon, your demon is not there anymore, so are you going to negotiate? If he now sees the opportunity to strengthen support for his disengagement plan in that direction, he might take it.
So it might help him take the edge off the resistance he's seen in the fears about the Gaza pullout. Robert Mnuchin, what do you think?
I think that, in fact, American involvement soon could be helpful in two respects, not in terms of getting ultimately to the deal that many who have studied the project have in mind, but instead facilitating two things. First, elections in Gaza that work.
Help make those happen in the coming soon.
Help make them happen and make sure that Sharon doesn't in any way interfere with it.
And second, quickly, we've got a break coming in.
And secondly, as Ian Lustig has suggested, facilitate some sort of deal with respect to the withdrawal from Gaza, not linking it to the ultimate final status issues. There can be no agreement
but
now.
But get some
on
action
that
in this new environment. Robert Mnuchin, Fawaz Yirshay's Ian Lustig, please stand by. We're talking tonight about new opportunities for Mideast peace with the death of Yasser Arafat. Does Washington have a chance of getting the stable Middle East President Bush describes if this conflict goes unresolved? We're at 1-800-423-825. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about new opportunities, maybe, for Mideast peace with the death of Yasser Arafat. I'm joined tonight from Sarah Lawrence College by Fawaz Yirshay, from the University of Pennsylvania by Ian Lustig, and from Harvard Law School by Robert Mnuchin. You can join this conversation as well. Does the Bush administration have the energy, the inclination, the commitment to push all sides now hard for peace? And are we kidding ourselves tonight? Does Arafat's death change nothing in the fundamentals here? And there's this: could George Bush get engaged and claim the peacemaking mantle that Bill Clinton missed? Can you picture it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike is calling from Scambia, Minnesota. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with the supporters that Bush has back here in the States. Many of them are Christian conservatives who believe in the imminent coming of their interpretation of the biblical end times, and that Israel has to be from the biblical territory, and do not believe in a two-state solution. They believe in the reconstruction of the Temple Mount before
right.
the Second Coming. So how would his supporters
maybe have Bush not do anything and remain totally disengaged.
Mike, let us pick that up, and thanks for your call. Ian Lustig, you talked about the hawks in Washington who may not be eager for negotiation here. But what about at the political level, the electoral level? The support George Bush had from evangelicals was strong, and as Mike points out, some number of them have turned out to be ardent supporters of Israel and kind of the status quo in Israel. Do you see Bush being influenced by that in a second term?
Well, we'll learn a lot more about George Bush than we know now. In the first term, you can make the argument, as Karl Rove can make the argument, look, George, you've got to deal with, you've got to make your base happy. They've got to turn out in large numbers in 2004 or you might not win. Well, that argument can't be made anymore because he can't be reelected. He can't be elected again. But now the question is whether actually W believes the stuff that he's been saying, believes the things that the evangelicals, some of them believe, and can he pick people to advise him who, such as Secretary of State Colin Powell, do understand that the way forward between Israelis and Palestinians is also the way forward for a balanced and stable, peaceful Middle East. And that we just don't know. But I do not believe that the political rationale that did exist to toe the line of the Israel lobby and of the fundamentalist Christians in this country any longer has the imperative associated with it that George Bush may have thought it did before the election.
Of course, he's got his own. He may have his own beliefs here. We don't know exactly where those stand, but he's
not really know.
But except that he's repeatedly said that he wants to see two states in peace, side by side. Let's get another call here. David is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
Just a comment. I appreciate the comments that your guests have made. I think good points on both sides. I think though, to look at this issue rather than looking at the intransigence on the Israeli side, maybe the ineptitude of Arafat and some of the things that the Palestinians have done, I think we have to look at what is the real issue, the real reason why we have not seen any moves towards peace. Let's face it, without the United States, this cannot exist. And in the United States, we have to realize politically the reality is that because of groups such as AIPAC and a host of about 60 other pro-Israeli groups, both sides of the aisle, right up to the president, have absolutely no way that they are going to push Israel in any direction to make any compromises.
But David, you know there are many Israelis that would like to see peace achieved. So
no, I understand that. But that's why, in some points, I really blame our politicians right here in this country above and beyond Israelis, because they have the ability to put pressure where it needs to be pushed and are simply incapable of doing it because of their own self-serving political interests.
David, let us pick up on that, and thank you for your call. Robert Nukin, we're expanding the circle here. Again, here's the event. Yasser Arafat, now dead. Does it change the political chemistry, the matrix of pressures inside the United States, including the American Jewish community?
Well, I think that, in fact, Arafat's death, for reasons that have been described, does change things. And I think it's also true that there are powerful American constituent groups, including the Jewish community, and I think with respect to George W. Bush, perhaps even more importantly, the evangelical community, that do not want to see Israel pressured. On the other hand, it's hard to imagine an American president who invested more capital in trying to create a solution than President Clinton. And he spent years educating himself, and at the end of his administration, he threw himself into this process.
So has something changed between the Clinton era and now? Is George Bush somehow more hobbled by domestic pressure than Bill Clinton was?
No, I don't think he's more hobbled at all. I think, though, what can be exaggerated is the capacity of the United States to bring about a solution without more progress resolving these behind-the-table conflicts on both sides. As long, for example, as it's difficult internally to remove West Bank settlers.
Right, and it is.
And it is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, look what difficulty Sharon is having, the champion of the settlers,
right,
from the center-right trying to do it from Gaza alone. And as long as it's difficult within the Palestinian community for even moderate leaders in any way to try to control the militias, mm-hmm, or reduce
the violence,
the violence and the terror. Grand progress is going to be very difficult.
Fawaz Shirshis, jump in here with us. The claim here, the United States influence is much more limited.
Not at all. Actually, without American leadership, Ariel Sharon will not move forward. American influence is vital and crucial.
Sure, the influence is there, but Robert Mnuchin is saying, look behind the leaders, and you've got real interests in Israel. Of course, Rabin, you know, he was assassinated, and you've got real interest in the Palestinian community, terrorist actors.
Tom, no one is suggesting it's going to be an easy journey. No one is suggesting it's going, but it takes leadership. It takes vision. It takes investment, political investment. And let's remember, after all, President Clinton almost succeeded. I mean, look at the progress that was done in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Almost succeeded. And in fact, we know what happened in Taba after the Camp David summit. So you cannot say because President Clinton did not really succeed in achieving a breakthrough that American leadership does not make a difference. It does. This president, Tom, I mean, the truth is very transparent. This president came to office with the intention not to get involved actively in this particular theater.
Yeah, but
and
he's...
He did not invest. Not only, Tom, not only he did not invest major political capital in Palestinian-Israeli conflict, he gave Ariel Sharon a carte blanche. A carte blanche to brutally suppress the Palestinians.
But Fawaz Shirshis says George Bush is now up to his hips in Iraq. He's got all kinds of troops in Fallujah tonight, and now more fighting breaking out in Mosul. Big bloodletting today in Baghdad. He's got problems. Ian Lustig is saying he may need to get involved here to get international support.
Tom, logic and common sense says if you want to utilize public diplomacy, I mean, rationality says that trying to engage in Palestinian-Israeli peacemaking is the most effective mechanism to improve American standing and prestige in the eyes of Arabs and Muslims. The question on the table is already, Tom, some of the ideologues in the Bush administration are saying, well, listen, we're going to raise the ceiling for the new Palestinian leadership. We're not going to just ask of the new leadership what we used to ask from Arafat. The ceiling has been raised. And this is a code word, as we know, that now, even though that you might have a new leadership, a new Palestinian leadership, of course, that's not how some of the ideologues within the Bush administration see it. But I still would like to believe that this administration, as the president said yesterday and today, there is a small window of opportunity. Let's hope this administration deeply engages in the peace process, helps the new Palestinian leadership chart a new course and a new blueprint for peace.
Ian Lustig, engage with this point. We hear on the one hand a kind of concern that some of the vested interests on both sides that are anti-peace in their posture are so deeply entrenched that even the U.S. can't get past them. On the other side, Bill Clinton came so close, why couldn't we get that closer or do better?
Well, I agree that there are deeply entrenched interests, but I actually think they're more malleable than most people do.
Absolutely.
When Fawaz Shirshis says that President Clinton almost succeeded, I mean, that's correct. It's the kind of a thing that accidents happen. People make slightly incorrect decisions. If Barack had come to Camp David with the deal he put on the table 4 weeks later at Taba, I think there would have been a no intifada. He thought he could snooker Arafat for a little more on the ground than he could, and it didn't work out. But if you try that again and again, you're going to get to the top of the mountain if you got 95% of the way there the last time.
Could happen. Yet a lot of headwind.
The problem is that there's a couple different problems, but one of them is that you've got an inability in Israel so far to produce a government willing to actually stand down what is, I think, an essentially empty threat by the settlers that they will destroy the country if there's a Palestinian state created.
That they'll tear it apart politically.
That many prime ministers on the right have used to avoid doing something serious. Now, Rabin and Peres knew it existed, but they didn't deal with it properly. There are proper ways to deal with it. Sharon is actually using some of those techniques. Sharon is a master tactician. He's a terrible strategist. So my hope for the situation lies in the fact that he is doing things with respect to Gaza which will create much bigger opportunities, much bigger challenges than the disappearance of Arafat.
I want to try and get one more call in here. Stan is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And my question for your guest has to do with the interests of the neighboring states in this whole peace settlement.
Yeah.
We have talked about the force that the United States should bear on both the Israelis and the Palestinians to reach an agreement. But in the complicated calculus of the Middle East, we all know that it's not just settling with the Palestinians, but there are outstanding issues with the Syrians, with the Egyptians,
right.
with the Lebanese. And how do they have a role to play, and what effect would the U.S. influence on them make?
That's a terrific question. Thanks, Stan, for raising it. If I was yours, how about it? Yasser Arafat was not terribly popular with many Middle Eastern leaders, maybe with any. Does his departure change the chemistry of the neighbors?
You know, Tom, this is a great question. A great question because this is basically fleshes out the dramatic changes that have basically occurred on the regional scene. For the first time in history, Tom, and I think Ian agrees with me, I hope, that there has been a dramatic change in the position of the Arab states. For the first time in history, Tom, there is a consensus among Arab states that the Arab-Israeli conflict does more harm than good to the stability and durability of the Arab regime. And this is why the consensus is that the sooner the conflict is resolved, the better. Truly, by the way, never. There's a consensus. Arab states now are all anxious to move forward and settle this particular conflict according to the vision of two viable states living side by side. Truly, the only rejectionist state in the region today is basically the Israel's Ariel Sharon.
Robert Mnuchin, that is a very, very large claim. Do you see such a vast change here?
I think that claim is wrong. There's no question but that Iran, which is, of course, not an Arab state, is providing all kinds of support for Hamas. And
but
what
about that more inner circle?
Well,
I hear Fawaz saying he doesn't mean Iran.
The notion that within Syria or even within Saudi Arabia, there aren't some groups that would like to be spoilers because it's functionally useful to keep this pot boiling.
But predominantly now, do you see a change?
Look, I agree with much of what's been said. I think without American involvement, there cannot be much progress. What I don't agree with is the notion that with American involvement, things are going to be easy. To the contrary, I think, in fact, the huge stake we all should have if we're interested in peace is that the withdrawal from Gaza succeed. And that isn't the whole business. It's not going to solve all problems. But in fact, making it a bilateral, not unilateral, in the sense of involvement with a new Palestinian regime, I think would be extremely valuable. And I think the United States government, that should be the focus of our energy for the next year.
So try and get the new Palestinian leadership on board with that. And yet, of course, there's been resistance to the whole idea when it was seen as unilateral. A fascinating conversation tonight. Much more to be said here, but a good beginning. Robert Mnuchin, here with me in the studio, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Fawaz Jurjez at Sarah Lawrence College. Always great to have you, Fawaz. Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Ian Lustig at the University of Pennsylvania. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.